From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
He was on his way when someone informed him that Sam Hose had already been lynched. And not only that, but that his knuckles were on sale in a grocery store a few blocks ahead on the same street that Du Bois was walking on. And Du Bois immediately kind of just like stopped in his tracks and said, "Oh my God."
On today's program, we'll look at the history of lynching as we focus our attention on the history of race relations in America. Also, the life and work of the African-American novelist Zora Neale Hurston. And we'll listen to some of the legendary soul music produced by Stax Records, the racially integrated record company.
I sometimes call it the organic manifestation of Dr. Martin Luther King's dream, in that, as opposed to busing, which attempted to force blacks and whites to share resources, to interact together, here were blacks and whites that had come together for a common purpose.
Randall Kennedy is a Harvard Law professor. He's also the author of a book called Interracial Intimacies: Sex, Marriage, Identity, and Adoption. Kennedy told Steve Paulson the true story of Jacqueline Henley.
What happened in brief is that in 1952, a white woman in New Orleans gave birth to a child. And as soon as this woman gave birth, she was overcome by a stroke, which left her paralyzed and speechless. The birth mother's sister takes the child home and commits herself to raising the child as her own. But the child starts turning darker day by day. And remember what I said, this is early 1950s, New Orleans, Louisiana. Neighbors complain, and the sister takes the child to New Orleans authorities and says, "Listen, I have to surrender this child. I have to abandon this child because my neighbors are complaining. They think that the biological father of the child was a Negro, and they're not going to stand for it." At that point, a black couple seeks to adopt the child, and everything looks like it's going to be okay. It's moving forward. But then it is found that the child has white stamped on her birth certificate.
In other words, the black couple is not going to be able to adopt this child.
That's right, because there was a law in Louisiana that expressly prohibited adoption across the race line. Most Jim Crow states did not have such laws, probably because legislators thought that there was no need for it. I mean, it was so inconceivable that anyone would adopt across the race line that most places didn't think that they had to pass such laws. But Louisiana, being particularly punctilious in these manners, did have such a law. And so the black couple that sought to adopt said, "Well, let's just change the birth certificate." But the Louisiana authorities would not allow the birth certificate to be changed because under Louisiana law, to change the race on someone's birth certificate required there being certainty as to the person's race. And here there was not certainty with respect to the race of this little girl because nobody knew who the biological father was. So the black couple was prevented from adopting this child. She was taken from the black couple. She was put into an orphanage, a black orphanage, not a white orphanage, because though she was legally deemed to be white, the state had special dispensation to put her in a black orphanage. That's what I read. I mean, that was the end of the reported case in the law reports. Mm-hmm. And this case really haunted me because I thought, here's this child around my age who was really condemned to legal and racial limbo in the early 1950s.
And the black couple even took this case to court, but as it turned out, they were not allowed to adopt Jacqueline Henley.
That's right.
Now, this happened 50 years ago. Is interracial adoption still such a contentious issue?
Oh, yes. It's a very controversial subject. The law has changed. So in the mid-1990s, the Congress of the United States passed two statutes, one in 1994, then a strengthening amendment in 1996 that prohibits race matching, that is to say, the policy of preferring children of a given race to be raised adoptively by adults of the same race. The Congress of the United States prohibited that by any agency taking money from the federal government.
But it's still going to come down to the actual adoption agencies and what they do. I mean,
yes,
how they actually place
that's
a child.
Right. Race matching, the strong preference, or even in some places the requirement for children of a given race to be raised by adults of the same race, that's on the legal defensive. but it is still practiced. I mean, there's a big difference between the law on the books and the law in action. The law on the books puts a real pall, really discourages race matching. But as a matter of policy, race matching is still very prevalent across the United States.
Now, you come out very strongly against race matching.
Yes,
you say this should not be an issue.
That's right.
Why?
For two main reasons. One is just practical. Race matching slows down the process of adoption. It is one more bureaucratic administrative hoop to jump through. Now, the more bureaucratic administrative hoops you've got to jump through, the slower the process is for adopting children. Delay is a danger in and of itself. If you've got a child 6 months old, a year old, 2 years old, 5 years old, delay is a bad thing because these are children that need homes. They need somebody to call mommy and daddy. They need somebody who's going to be responsible for them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
So what, they're going to be put in foster care?
They're going to be put on in short-term foster care, bumped around in short-term foster care, or they're going to be put in institutionalized settings, both of which are decidedly inferior to the permanent adoptive settings. Racial minority children are the children that are disproportionately affected by race matching. Let's go back to my home state, Massachusetts. Half the children there that are eligible for adoption are racial minority children. The racial minority population of Massachusetts is maybe 15%. Now, racial minorities do adopt. In fact, with respect to African Americans, they adopt beyond their percentage of the population. But there's always going to be this gap, or at least now, currently, and for the foreseeable future, there will be a gap between the numbers of blacks who are available for adoption and the number of black kids or other racial minority kids who are available for adoption. So the question then becomes, well, what about that gap?
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't allow, you know, white people or other people to adopt these children are going to be out in the cold.
Let me shift the discussion to interracial dating and interracial sex. We've been talking about adoption so mm-hmm. far, but is this as loaded an issue as adoption?
I don't think it's quite as loaded an issue. You don't have lawsuits over interracial dating and interracial marriage. Sometimes you have lawsuits. So, for instance, if somebody is fired from their job or if somebody is excluded as a renter or somebody is excluded as a potential buyer of a house because they're in an interracial relationship, that might give rise to a lawsuit. But basically, the legal system no longer throws up impediments to interracial dating or interracial marriage. But is it still controversial? Yes.
Is it more controversial among black people or white people?
Well, probably still more controversial, frankly, among white people. Most white people say now that they don't have a problem with an interracial marriage. But in many places, you know, white people will ostracize other white people who are involved in interracial intimacy. Now, let's talk about black people for a while. Historically, there has been an important segment of the black community that has been hostile toward interracial intimacy, particularly interracial marriage. They were against laws prohibiting interracial marriage because they understood those laws to be against black people. They understood those laws to essentially be saying that black people were so contaminating that white people needed this protection of the state against black people. But black people, or at least a segment of black society, has always viewed with suspicion, even scorn, other blacks who crossed the race line for marriage. Frederick Douglass in 1882 married a white woman. His first wife was a black woman. Frederick Douglass and his first wife had a long marriage. She died, left him a widower. Soon thereafter, he remarried. He remarried a white woman who had been an abolitionist. Well, there were a lot of black people who said Frederick Douglass has betrayed the race.
Why do some black people get angry when blacks marry outside the race?
there are a whole set of reasons why there's this, within some black circles, there's really a reaction against blacks marrying outside the race. And part of it has to do with the feeling that some black people who marry non-blacks, there's a feeling that they are trying to distance themselves from other black people, that they are distancing themselves from blackness, that in a sense, intermarriage becomes a vehicle for assimilation. This is especially true when it's a black man, especially a prominent black man, especially a high-achieving black man who marries a white woman.
Is this going to be his way, his path to success?
Well, maybe his path to success, or insofar as he has become successful, is the white woman serving as, in a sense, the final confirmation of his success, the ultimate trophy. There are a lot of black women who are very resentful of black men because there are many black women who think that black men who marry white women, or at least some black men who marry white women, are showing that they have bought into a system that still privileges whiteness. There's this sense that at least some black men, when they marry white women, are indicating that they think that whiteness is preferable, that they think that white women are more appealing. And so this also is part of the resentment that some black people feel against other blacks who marry whites.
Now, I know one of the questions that you've gotten asked a lot since this book has come out is, who are you married to?
Yeah, no, it is a question. And I've found that people are very hesitant often to ask me that, but I'm glad you did. I'm married to a black woman. You know, I've had many very close white friends, but my wife is black. I think that a lot of people assume that I am married to a white woman because in my book I take such a strong position against any sort of state-sponsored or any sort of communal impediments to interracial intimacy. One of the reasons why I'm happy that you asked the question is because I think that some people believe that my resistance, in fact, vigorous, passionate attack upon racial impediments to intimacy, a lot of people think, this fellow is just, it's a personal apology. He's just trying to justify his own situation. And, no, for various reasons that I give in my book, I think that racial impediments to intimacy are one of the real tragedies of American life. Lots of love and affection and friendship have been thwarted. These emotions have been thwarted, distorted, stunted by the embarrassment, by the contempt, by the ostracism that has been put upon those who have sought to, show their affection across the race line. And I think that that's terrible.
Randall Kennedy is the author of Interracial Intimacies, Sex, Marriage, Identity, and Adoption. He spoke with Steve Paulson. All of Zora Neale Hurston's books were out of print when she died, broke, in 1960. But Hurston's received great acclaim since her death. Noted black writers like Maya Angelou, Toni Morrison, and Alice Walker acknowledge the influence that Zora Neale Hurston had on their work. Hurston's novel, Their Eyes Were Watching God, is considered her masterpiece. Here's Cynthia Adams with an excerpt.
I was with them white children so much till I didn't know I wasn't white till I was round 6 years old. Wouldn't have found it out then. But a man come along taking pictures, and without asking anybody, Shelby, that was the oldest boy, he told him to take us. Round a week later, the man brought the picture for Miss Washburn to see and pay him, which she did, then give us all a good licking. So when we looked at the picture and everybody got pointed out, there wasn't nobody left except a real dark little girl with long hair standing by Eleanor. That's where I was supposed to be, but I couldn't recognize that dark child as me. So I asked, where's me? I don't see me. Everybody laughed. Miss Nellie, the mama of the children who had come back home after her husband dead, she pointed to the dark one and said, "That's you, Alphabet. Don't you know your own self?" They all used to call me Alphabet because so many people had done named me different names. I looked at the picture a long time and seen it was my dress and my hair, and I said, "Oh, I'm colored." Then they all laughed real hard. But before I seen the picture, I thought I was just like the rest.
That's an excerpt from Their Eyes Were Watching God by Zora Neale Hurston. Valerie Boyd says that she really related to the novel the first time she read it. Boyd went on to write Wrapped in Rainbows, The Life of Zora Neale Hurston.
As a 17 or 18-year-old college freshman, I was embarking on a journey to know myself. And that's exactly what that book is about. It's about this woman named Janie Crawford, who is beginning a journey of self-realization, self-discovery. And the book follows Janie through her journey from age 16 all the way up to her 40s when the book ends. And I was just attracted to Janie and her story. Even beyond that, I was just really curious about the writer who created this kind of proto-feminist novel. Yeah. In the 1930s.
It was kind of an unusual book for its time as well, wasn't it?
Absolutely. I think that's what drew me to Zora Neale Hurston, the fact that she was writing this kind of book about the inner life of an ordinary black woman in the 1930s. That's what really struck me about her and made me want to know more about Zora Neale Hurston herself.
Some people reacting to it have reacted badly to the fact that she used Southern black dialect. And that didn't turn you away, I gather.
No, and I think it didn't really turn readers away in droves when she wrote the book. I think contemporary readers tend to react to that more because we are removed from that kind of language and may have difficulty reading it. For me, growing up in the South, you know, it was the language of my grandparents. So I was able to read it and very quickly and easily adapt to the dialect in the book because it was the language that my grandparents spoke, being black Southerners.
In the 1890s, when she was just a toddler, Zora Neale Hurston moved with her family to Eatonville, Florida. What impact did living there have on her?
Because it was an all-black town, it was, in fact, the nation's first incorporated black town. Eatonville was a place where Zora Neale Hurston and other children like her were largely shielded from racism, and so they were never indoctrinated in inferiority. For Zora Neale Hurston, this meant that she developed an extraordinary sense of what Alice Walker calls racial health. She was really gifted with an amazing sense of identity and a sense of potential, of her own potential, her own possibilities to do whatever she wanted to do. And she also had great faith in black people generally because she had seen examples of black achievement all around her. The mayor of the town was black. The school teachers were black. Everyone in the town was black. And so she saw these examples of achievement and never doubted that she could be whatever she chose to be.
Mm. She was taken to task by some members of the black community, especially Richard Wright, for instance. I gather it may have been about Their Eyes Were Watching God. Thought that the way she used language was wrong.
Well, Richard Wright did write a very negative review of Their Eyes Were Watching God shortly after it was published in 1937. But he wasn't so much objecting to the language of the book as he was to the themes of the book. He felt that the book had no plot, as he put in his review, and no thought. And what he really objected to was the fact that Zora Neale Hurston was not writing overtly about racism. She was interested in writing about the inner lives of ordinary black people, and specifically in that book, of an ordinary black woman. Richard Wright found the inner life of a black woman not really worthy of literature. And of course, at the time, Richard Wright was writing social protest kinds of novels and really felt that this was the only kind of black literature that black writers could afford to write. So he took Zora Neale Hurston to task for not writing more overtly political material. And she, you know, she stood her ground and said, "I'm interested in what makes a man or a woman do such and so, regardless of color." So she was interested in writing about love and loyalty and passions and betrayal and the kinds of things that every human being deals with. And she was also interested in writing about what happens within the black community when that community is within itself, when they've shut the door on the white man, so to speak. I mean, her feeling was black people were not always thinking about oppression. Certainly racism exists. Certainly racism is a part of black experience, but that's not the only thing. And so she was interested in writing about those other kinds of themes that permeate black life and human life, frankly. And so she traded negative reviews with Richard Wright. She wrote negative reviews of his work and really questioned the obsession with race in his work and questioned the violence in his work as well.
Well, given her interest in interior life, it's kind of curious that she did take some very unpopular political position. I mean, she was opposed to the 1954 Supreme Court school desegregation decision, for instance. What was she thinking?
Well, she was thinking about Eatonville. She was thinking about her own upbringing in this all-black town where she went to all-black schools and got an excellent education. And so to her, Brown versus Board of Education was saying that, you know, black kids had to sit next to white kids in order to be better. And to her, that was accepting a notion of inferiority, which she absolutely rejected. So her political stance late in life, where she objected to Brown versus Board of Education, can be traced directly back to Eatonville and this experience of racial health in this all-black town, where she felt she received everything she needed. So in her view, segregation wasn't all that bad when equal resources were available. So, for instance, with Brown versus Board of Education, she said, well, why not put resources into black schools rather than forcing integration? And she also privately said to friends, you know, as a black person, she couldn't possibly be against integration, but she was against the kind of forcible integration that was being pushed at that time, and really felt that it was, as I said, accepting some notion of inferiority, which she could not accept in any way.
You've been to visit her grave. In fact, you went to her grave to ask her permission to write her biography.
That's right. I've visited her grave several times. The first time I went was after I had decided that I wanted to take on this work of writing her biography, and I did feel the need to go and ask for her permission. I felt that she was that kind of woman, the kind you couldn't act on her behalf without asking for her permission. And it was an interesting story because my agent, who's a very no-nonsense kind of guy, was wondering why I was going to the grave to ask for permission. He thought something spooky might happen, so he was a little concerned about me. But I went there, and I don't know what I expected exactly. I just felt like it was an offering, a gesture that I should make. And so I went to the grave, and I took some Florida oranges, because Zora always loved those. And I took some money, because she never had enough in her lifetime. And I took some Pall Malls, which she smoked, and those were hard to find in this day and age. But I took those things to her, and I just said a few words and made an offering. I have to back up a little bit and tell you that at the very first Zora Neale Hurston Festival of the Arts in Eatonville in 1990, there was a big black crow that was hanging out all during the festival. And this black crow was hanging out so much that people started calling this bird Zora. So then five years later, when I go to visit her grave and ask for her permission to write this biography of her life, I was there and I had made my offerings and I was getting up to leave. And this big black crow came and circled the cemetery. And so I felt that I had gotten my permission at that point.
Valerie Boyd's the author of Wrapped in Rainbows, The Life of Zora Neale Hurston. And this is Zora Neale Hurston singing the crow dance.
Oh, my mama, come see that crow. See how he flies. Oh, mama, come see that crow. See how he flies. This crow gonna fly tonight. See how he flies. This crow gonna fly tonight.
If you have questions or comments about the program, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at www.ttbook.org. Coming up, we'll continue to explore the history of race relations in America with some soul music from the racially integrated company Stax Records, and a look at the history of lynching. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Philip Dre is a noted civil rights historian. One of his books is called At the Hands of Persons Unknown, The Lynching of Black America. Dre told Anne Strainchamps about some lynchings during the 1890s.
Lynchings were huge public spectacles, huge events, often involving as many as 10,000 people. Photographs were taken of them, souvenirs were taken, they were much talked about. This was a way of not only reaffirming the strength of the white community, but also completely terrorizing the black community. Blacks who were hundreds of miles away from lynchings nonetheless knew about them and were terrified by them, and of course it was very intimidating.
One of the many lynching incidents you write about happened in April 1899 in Palmetto, Georgia. The victim was a 21-year-old black farm worker named Sam Hose. Would you tell us what happened?
Well, the Sam Hose case was interesting in that it was a case that no one really ever knew for certain what had happened. He was accused, though, of murdering his white boss and also raping the boss's wife. And it turned into a sort of an archetypal lynching in that he then disappeared for about 12 days, creating the need for this statewide manhunt that was just, you know, sort of rabid, really, and all the newspapers joined in. You know, that was a very important part of it, is the newspapers in those days really sort of were part of the lynch mob. They called it folk pornography. But the Atlanta Constitution and other papers kind of joined in to sort of find this man, Sam Hose. And his lynching was very, very graphic. It went on for an entire day. Excursion trains brought different, you know, news spectators from Atlanta to participate in it.
They had special trains?
Yes, exactly. That was very common, actually, because a lot of lynchings took place in small towns. It was very common for trains to come from the larger cities carrying hundreds of spectators to sort of join in.
So there's a kind of carnival or festival-like atmosphere to these things?
Very much so, and often kind of picnic-like, really.
So what happened to Sam Hose?
Well, the Sam Hose case was kind of important just in that it was one of the first cases to really galvanize opposition to lynching among people in the North. For instance, Ida B. Wells got involved. Lynchings of that era, these were called spectacle lynchings because they involved such a large audience. You know, a lot of people think lynchings mean hangings, but actually they often meant immolations. Lynchings were very ritualized. They often were protracted over several hours. The family of the victim was often given priority to sort of exact its revenge. If the victim was killed too quickly, it was considered a bad example of what they called lynchcraft, which was sort of this ritualized approach to execution.
I think the thing I find so just horrific about it is the violence is just is appalling and really hard to hear about. The dehumanization of the victim is just really hard to understand at all. I mean, you tell a story about the aftermath of the Sam Hose case. I mean, this is the case that really galvanized W.E.B. Du Bois into a very public stance against lynching. And well, you should tell the story about what happened.
Well, that's an interesting story. W.E.B. Du Bois was a professor at Atlanta University at the time, and he had heard about the Sam Hose case. This manhunt was going on, and, you know, gallant men were looking in the swamps, and it was the press was playing it up. And he thought he would write a letter to the Atlanta Constitution sort of explaining that, well, you know, these things are not always what they seem in these cases. You know, passions get sort of inflamed and et cetera. And he was on his way walking down to the Atlanta Constitution office one day when someone informed him that Sam Hose had already been lynched. And not only that, but that his knuckles were on sale in a grocery store a few blocks ahead on the same street that Du Bois was walking on. And Du Bois immediately kind of just like stopped in his tracks and said, oh my God, and never delivered the letter, basically just turned around, walked back to Atlanta University. And he always referred to that later as kind of this moment that just galvanized him, changed his thinking, in that he previously had thought that these type of problems could be, you know, reasonable people, both white and black, could come together. There could be discussion. These things could be alleviated in some way or addressed. But that this incident, the barbarity of it, had shown him that, no, something more strong was needed, that you could not really sit down and have a discussion about something like this and reason it out when this level of, you know, animal behavior was taking place.
If there is anything remotely uplifting about the history of lynching in America, it has to be the story of the people who tried to put an end to lynching. Du Bois was one of them. You also write about Ida B. Wells. And will you tell me about how she began or contributed to the anti-lynching movement?
Sure. Ida B. Wells was a journalist in Memphis in the early 1890s and had already kind of made a name for herself in a suit against a railroad that had evicted her from her seat on a train. So she was very much a rebel. What got her into the anti-lynching cause was that some friends of hers in Memphis, three black men, owned a grocery store. And she knew them to be completely reputable, upstanding young, you know, businessmen. They wanted to make a life for themselves. The grocery store did too well, and whites conspired to target it for harassment. There was some exchange of gunfire between people in the store, and these three men who Ida knew were all arrested and lynched, taken from jail and lynched in downtown Memphis. Prior to that, lynchings had often been talked about as necessary to sort of safeguard white women from black rapists. This was a common cause of lynchings that was being cited really until the middle of the 20th century. But what she perceived was that, well, no, it was not that at all. These men were killed because they were too successful. They were playing by the rules. They had a successful business, and yet they were lynched. And so this really kind of got her upset about it, and she began doing a lot of her own research into lynchings in the South and found that, indeed, in many, many cases, lynchings were taking place for just this reason, often with the kind of cover of a sexual assault, but that essentially blacks were being targeted for who they were. Maybe they were, you know, being a little too successful, too assertive. They owned something that whites wanted, what have you.
But in other words, this wasn't remotely about protecting the community from crime. This was about keeping blacks down.
Yes, right. She made that very important distinction that this was about a kind of collective repression in a way, and she began to editorialize about it.
As the 1890s wore on and in the early part of the 1900s, thanks in part to work by people like Ida B. Wells, the big spectacle lynchings became unacceptable. Lynching really became a kind of underground secret thing, which continued on up into the mid part of the century. There's one really notorious case, 1955, the case of Emmett Till. Will you tell something about that? Because that's a big piece of the more recent history of lynching.
The Emmett Till case was one of the first cases that really kind of, it was sort of attracted a lot of attention, partly because it seemed like something that was sort of a throwback. It happened in 1955. Emmett Till was a 14-year-old black teenager from Chicago who was visiting relatives in a small town in Mississippi. He encountered a white woman who worked in a grocery store. They call it the wolf whistle lynching because they say that he wolf whistled at this white woman or he said something kind of sassy. Nobody really knows. But a few nights later, her husband and brother-in-law came to the place where he was staying and took him away. And, of course, he was never seen alive again. His body was found in the river a few days later. This case became kind of a worldwide cause, really, because he was so young, for one thing. The cause of the lynching, the wolf whistle, was considered sort of frivolous, really. And also another reason was because for the first time you had television coverage. This case was one that really kind of resonated. And, you know, when the civil rights movement sort of took off later that year and in the late 1950s, a lot of black leaders kind of always mentioned the Emmett Till case as one that had been sort of galvanizing or wake-up call for a lot of black Southerners.
Well, and Emmett Till's mother, Mamie Till Bradley, became a pretty well-known anti-lynching activist, and she very wisely used the cameras and photographs to help make her case and help, I take her son's case to a wider audience. I mean, partly, she left his casket open.
Yes, that's right. That was a very important detail, was that she was very courageous, really. Not only did she go to the trial, but before that, when Emmett's body was shipped back to Chicago, you know, he had been hideously mutilated before he was killed. And, you know, the undertaker immediately said, well, we're going to close this coffin. And, you know, she said, no, I want it to be open. And, you know, he said, please, you can't do that. That's ridiculous. But she insisted. She said, I want the whole world to see what Mississippi did to my son. And, of course, that became this very well-known, the photograph. Anyone who has seen it knows it's this really horrifying image. And it sort of went around the world, and that also then helped to kind of stir a lot of interest and concern about this case.
Philip Dre is the author of At the Hands of Persons Unknown, The Lynching of Black America. He spoke with Anne Strainchamps.
Was down in Mississippi not so long ago, when a young boy from Chicago town walked in a southern door. This boy's fateful tragedy you should all remember well. The color of his skin was black, and his name was Emmett Till.
Coming up, the story of Stax Records.
Color literally disappeared when you walked into Stax. As mythic as that might seem, I really believe it was quite true until the late 1960s, when things changed for a number of reasons. Early and mid-60s, Stax was virtually colorblind.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Rob Bowman is a musicologist. He won a Grammy Award a few years ago for the liner notes he wrote for a box set celebrating the Southern soul music of Stax Records. Bowman is also the author of a book called Soulsville, USA, The Story of Stax Records. The Stax Records story begins in Memphis, Tennessee, with a white man named Jim Stewart, who worked at a bank and played country fiddle on the weekends during the late 1950s. He started his own label called Satellite Records. The label released 11 records, country and pop music songs, that were all bad, except for one. But Rob Bowman says that Jim Stewart's fortunes changed when he opened his second recording studio.
Jim's second studio was developed in a neighborhood that was rapidly turning from white to black. It was a neighborhood on the south side of Memphis where he'd found an abandoned movie theater that he thought would make a great recording studio. His idea was a moving theater, these really high ceilings, great acoustics, perfect space. He'd been looking for either a church or movie theater. And again, the neighborhood he found it in happened to be turning from white to black, as happened in so many inner city neighborhoods in the United States. And when he moved, it was integrated. Knocking on the door very quickly were some of the local black residents saying, hey, what's all going in here? I hear you've got a recording studio. And Jim, not having much success with his country and pop records, being close to bankruptcy in this project, thought, what the heck? Decided to record a record by a local Memphis disc jockey, and he's partially being pragmatic here. He's got a black disc jockey with a gig on WDIA, which was the first black-oriented radio station in the United States and a powerhouse in Memphis in 1960, who wants to record. So he records Rufus Thomas and his daughter Carla Thomas. They put out a record called 'Cause I Love You, and it immediately becomes a local hit, selling about 30,000 copies.
Let me tell you, hurting, let me down inside.
Atlantic Records in New York City hears about it from their Mid-South distributor, and they think, hey, why don't we pick up distribution? They phone Jim up, cut him a check for, if my memory serves me correct, only $1,000. But to Jim, this $1,000 was like a million. This was like manna from heaven. This was a company that was about to go under. He suddenly had a hit, a New York company willing to distribute him, and money in the bank. And as he put it to me, his eyes were forever wide open. And of course, black music became virtually entirely what Stax was about.
He and his sister were involved in setting this up, right? That's where Stax comes from?
Well, the ST from Stuart, the AX from Estelle Axton, A-X-T-O-N is her last name, so you put S-T-A-X-T, yeah. You get Stax.
And she had a pretty good sense of music?
Well, Estelle was brought in, not at the beginning, Jim started it with a couple other partners, but he brought her in when he needed some money to buy better recording equipment, and so he asked her if she'd mortgage her house. She became a partner who ended up operating a record store in the front of the movie theater that had become their recording studio. What had been the candy snack bar became a record store, and that was Estelle's main function. Same time, you know, there were a few artists that she was instrumentally involved in. She paved the way for Albert King to be signed to the label. She signed a group called the Mad Lads. And her son, Packy Axton, was in a group called the Marquees, which also had people like Steve Cropper and Duck Dunn. Those who know the Stax story will know they became half of Booker T and the MGs, the house band of Stax. But Estelle's son was in that band, and they put out a record called Last Night. It became a huge instrumental hit in the fall of 1961. So Estelle had an impact on the company musically, but I should say one other thing. You know, the record store she ran in the snack bar was really important to this story. Most record companies are located in industrial parks in the suburbs or they're in downtown office buildings. Stax was within a community, within a residential neighborhood. So she's got this retail store and all the neighborhood kids are coming in there and hanging out. And a number of those kids were people like Booker T. Jones, who become Stax session musicians. Some ways, the store she ran was a conduit for relationships with the neighborhood in general, but also a recruiting center for prospective talent. And Estelle was a person with a, you know, personality that was larger than life, wide open, welcoming. She really was the public front of Stax and did wonders in terms of who she brought into the company. So I think that was quite important, let alone working the record store gave her a sense of what the market was. They'd often test recordings that they'd cut in the studio, play them in the record store, see if people started asking what they were.
One of the great things about this story, it seems to me, that also involves Estelle is that they were placed in the middle of a black community, but they don't seem to mind that. They were both white, and a lot of the musicians were black. It was, in fact, one of the first racially integrated companies, wasn't it?
Well, in fact, from top to bottom, it started with white ownership, but by 68 had black and white ownership, equal 50-50. The first person hired was a white secretary. The second person hired was a black secretary. And the house band, Booker T and the MGs, are two black musicians, two white musicians in the rhythm section. So we're talking about a company integrated from bottom to top in Memphis, Tennessee in the early 1960s. You got to think, the fact that I always mention is, as late as 1971, Memphis decided to close all of its public swimming pools rather than integrate them under a federal order. So it decided white kids weren't going to get to swim and cool off if it meant black kids were going to be in the same pool. This was an amazingly racist city. And here's this oasis, if you will, Stax Records, of racial sanity. I sometimes call it the organic manifestation of Dr. Martin Luther King's dream, in that, as opposed to busing, which attempted to force blacks and whites to share resources, to interact together, here were blacks and whites that had come together for a common purpose. And as many, many, many people who I interviewed for this project told me, you know, color literally disappeared when you walked into Stax. As mythic as that might seem, I really believe it was quite true until the late 1960s when things changed for a number of reasons. Early and mid-60s, Stax was virtually colorblind. If you listen to the sound of Stax, you'll hear elements of gospel and R&B, but you also hear country and pop elements. You really hear the sound of soul was a product of this impulse towards integration.
There was no problem within the company, the white folks wanting to do one kind of music, the black folks wanting to do a different kind of music. They simply developed a sound of their own.
Absolutely. You know, a lot of the white people who came to work at the company, especially as musicians, were already infatuated with black music and in many ways saw themselves as white hipsters playing black music. So that was never an issue. But I think even more interesting, or as interesting and maybe even more seminal, was the fact that at the level of secretary, promotion man, salesman, marketing people, executives, black and white, working hand to hand, promoting and selling black culture, but black culture that had been influenced by aspects of white culture as well, which was Southern soul music.
One of Stax Records' most famous recording artists was Otis Redding. How did he come to Stax?
Otis Redding came there in 1962 in the summer, and it's kind of a circuitous route. Atlantic had picked up a single by a gentleman named Johnny Jenkins, who was a guitarist from Macon, Georgia, and Otis happened to sing in Johnny Jenkins' band. But the single that Atlantic Records had picked up was an instrumental single called Love Twist. Well, if you remember, I mentioned earlier Atlantic was distributing Stax after the initial success that Stax had had with Rufus and Carla Thomas, so Atlantic got the idea, let's send Johnny Jenkins to Memphis to cut a follow-up single at Stax. So Johnny comes there. He's managed by a guy named Phil Walden. And Johnny, Phil, and Otis hatched up a plan where Johnny would record his follow-up single, but he would try to allow, 30, 40 minutes at the end of the session. He'd try to be finished 30 or 40 minutes early. So at that point, Otis Redding could say, hey, I sing. Could I have a chance to record? And the way Otis was introduced to everybody was that he was Johnny Jenkins' driver. They thought he was virtually a valet, and it's just a guy sitting in the studio waiting for the guy who's driving to finish. Then he said, hey, I can sing. Can I have a chance to sing? And I was sort of like, why not? We got the studio. Let's do this. And, of course, he opens his mouth and sings These Arms of Mine, the song that he'd also had written.
These arms of mine.
And everybody is like, whoa, what was that? And of course, Otis becomes signed to Stax. The funny thing is the Johnny Jenkins single doesn't come out for 2 years and is a failure when it does come out, and his career is virtually over. Otis Redding becomes probably the most important Stax artist in the 60s, backed up by Booker T and the MGs on every one of his records. And Otis, in many ways, was instrumental in developing the Stax sound. Certainly the horn instrumental ensemble sound of Stax was Otis Redding's creation. So not just is he a great singer for things like Respect, I've Been Loving You Too Long, later Sitting on the Dock of the Bay, but he also was responsible for the sound of the horn section on Southern Soul records.
Lost Otis Redding in 1967, then in 68, Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated there in Memphis, not very far from Stax Records. Did that have an impact on Stax?
The assassination of Dr. King in April 1968 forever changed everything. Certainly changed racial relationships in the United States, certainly affected Memphis deeply, but it also affected Stax. A number of things begin to happen. Black militancy gains a lot of currency. A lot of people feel here's Dr. King, who was attempting to change the world of the United States through peaceful means. And obviously, look what happens to him. He's simply gunned down in cold blood. And a number of black militants began to look at Stax and saying, hey, here's this white-owned company in a black neighborhood. They need to pay protection money. And Stax begins to get shaken down by some local hoodlums. They didn't realize, actually, the company was half black-owned, but that didn't matter. They were shaking the place down. And Al Bell, who we haven't talked about, was a black individual who had come to the company in 65 as a promotion man and ended up co-owning the company with Jim Stewart in 68. Al Bell goes through a contact of his and gets a couple of heavy-duty gangster-type guys from New York City to come down to deal with the hoodlums that are shaking down Stax. Now, these guys were the solution to a problem, but then they became a problem. They were also pretty militant and had an attitude and an issue with Stax having so many white employees and white participants in the creative domains of the company. And as Wayne Jackson, a trumpet player who was there from the very beginning, said to me, he had never felt he was white until that time period. Suddenly people are looking at him differently, talking to him differently, guns are around, people are getting threatened. And a number of people like Steve Cropper, who was also white, the guitarist in Booker T and the MGs, leaves, Wayne Jackson leaves. The company does change. Al Bell forever wanted to be understood as an integrated company, so much so that he wouldn't give Black Enterprise magazine company statistics. Black Enterprise magazine in the early 70s wanted to list Stax as one of the three or four most successful black businesses in the United States. And Al Bell said, we're not a black business. We're an integrated business. But the reality is, after Dr. King's death, things became certainly more Afrocentric at Stax. And there's nothing wrong with Afrocentrism. But within some of the newer people at the company, that got translated into an anti-white sentiment. Yeah. People had been at the company for years and years and years, maintained their open attitude towards racial integration, but the company attitude and flavor did change.
Stax Records has been such a big part of your life. Do you have a favorite Stax recording?
I have many, but if I had to simply pick one single favorite Stax recording, it would have to be Try a Little Tenderness by Otis Redding.
Does that have the quintessential Stax sound?
Absolutely. It's also coincidentally, and I say coincidentally because it was my favorite record before I knew this, but Jim Stewart, the gentleman who founded Stax, told me that's also his favorite Stax recording, and I think for the very same reasons that it's mine.
Oh, she may be weary. Them young girls, they do get weary wearing that same old shaggy dress, yeah. But when she gets weary, try a little tenderness, yeah, yeah.
Otis Redding with Try a Little Tenderness. Rob Bowman is the author of Soulsville, USA, the story of Stax Records. Stax Records went bankrupt in 1975, and the Stax building was torn down in 1989. But now, the Stax Museum of American Soul Music has opened where the original building used to stand. And Rob Bowman was very involved in the creation of the museum. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Tim Fleming. If you'd like a cassette copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 105A, Race Relations. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Steve Paulson, Anne Strainchamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickard, with engineering help from Marv Nunn.
PRI, Public Radio International.